Are you interested in improving your procurement and negotiation skills and understanding? Well, this is the podcast for you. The Procurement Podcast with Andy and Christoph.
Welcome to another episode of the Procurement Podcast. I am Christoph Bayer-Varjou from advanced procurement consulting firm BBW Global. Along to my side is Andy Franks from Brightscar ClearMind. And on the podcast this week, we have Myla Buerlan from the New South Wales Department of Education and Tania Leilong.
Lola.
Well, I'll get there. Won't you? it's been a long day. From the local government procurement. Welcome to the show,
Andy.
Well, yeah. So, quite often, one of the questions we ask is what is procurement? But today is going to be slightly different, and we're just going to go through just particularly talk around circular economy, I think. I suppose a really good starting point is to, you know, what is circular economy?
Well, I can answer that. Why don't we give some definition to our listeners? I've taken the definition from ISO 2400, which was adopted from the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. And it says, circular economy is economy that is restorative and regenerative by design, and which aims to keep products, components, and materials at their highest utility and value at all times. Isn't it fantastic? So what it really means is that we have to change our approach to our economy from linear, which we take, we make, and then we waste anything that we don't like anymore, into circular, where we try to loop in everything that we could so that we design out waste. Mm-hmm. And I would like to add that in circular economy definition, there are three principles and five activities. So I'd like to mention that very briefly. Cool. The first principle is to design out waste and pollution. The second principle is keep products and materials in use. And third, regenerate natural systems. So we'll pick that up again, I guess, during our discussion. And the six activities that fit into those three principles are to regenerate, to share, optimize, loop, virtualize, and exchange.
So where do we start with all this? So it's pretty much the old way of doing things is we pick stuff from the ground, we manufacture it, we use it, and then we dispose of it and fills up the bin with it. And then the new ways of doing things is trying to use material that can be recycled, so we don't have to go back to the raw source of extracting rocks and making chips and those sort of things, and finding ways to recycle what we already have as opposed to recreating, you know, from scratch. Yeah.
That's right. So you mentioned recycle, that's one component. But there are also many ways of circular economy, and you also mentioned reuse and repurpose. And I guess it's a very, very broad topic. The idea is to treat our resources as finite.
Yeah.
Because we don't want to end up depleting our resources in our planet. So as much as possible, we want to prolong the utility of a product. We want to repurpose it. We want to reuse it. And recycling is one important component which has the lesser value of some. That's why in manufacturing, recycling is probably one of the lesser ways that they would like.
But it's so much simpler just to buy things and then just get rid of it. Are we ever going to change that mindset? I know this is not what we want to hear, and that's not where we want to go. But you know, the convenience factor of, you know, this phone is obsolete after 6 months, and we're being bombarded by the next generation phone, 4Gs, 5Gs, and the phones that collect better photos than the previous one, and the whole consumer experience is geared toward that overconsumption, that fast economy. And now we are saying, oh, hang on a minute, let's slow down. Let's see how far we can use that item.
I think that's a pretty straightforward answer, though. So I think the convenience of being able to breathe is really, really convenient. So if you're living on a planet where you can no longer breathe, that's not very convenient. So
It's true.
Sorry.
Tanya.
It's true. But most people don't really consider that, do they? They still see that as something that is rather long term and not going to impact them.
Yes, yeah, I think that there's a very clear sort of, well, yeah, that might be a problem for my and my grandchildren, but you know, they're healthy at the moment, they're running around, they're okay. But I think that sort of that short-termism is you know, has got us to this position that we're in now, and that's where, you know, by looking at things from, you know, making that transition from a linear economy as it's described to a circular economy is really it's essential, isn't it? I mean, it is a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. But you know, but Christoph, if you want to keep on throwing stuff away.
I'm taking the view of, you know, the population anywhere in the world has not been trained. Maybe the original populations, you know, the Aboriginal and the local Indians, and you know, they knew how to take care of the environment, so the environment will take care of them. But we've moved from that world to the manufacturing world, where profit is king, where corporations want to make money, and they are very competitive, and we get to a point where manufacturing something from scratch is cheaper than recycling another item. So we come to the point where, are we doing the right thing and paying more? Or are we doing the wrong thing and saving a bit of money for us? And it comes to the point where, you know, your moral values are really being tested. You know, are you willing to spend more money because this phone is recycled? Or are you willing to, and not as good as the latest manufacturer ABC? So you're paying more for less value versus paying less for higher values, which is, one is create, make, dispose, versus one that has been recycled.
So it's interesting because you pointed out a few aspects in there. So in that sentence, you've actually probably covered three areas. So you're talking about value. So circular economy is value creation and value retention. And many organizations have actually found that they find it more profitable if they engage a circular economy approach. The second thing is our consumption. If we keep on taking, making, and wasting, we will end up with a lot of waste. And so it's called the China Sword Policy, is now upon us. And Tanya is very familiar with this, and maybe you can add something to that one, that they have already stopped buying waste from Australia.
Yeah.
So now we have the problem of treating that problem, and how do we approach it? We have now started thinking about recycling and using recyclable products. That's why in this conversation, we'd very much like to link it to procurement and what local government and New South Wales government is doing.
So that, I think that's a really neat way to get us to sort of, so if you've got a circular economy, then it therefore the logical extension of that is we'll have circular procurement. So
correct.
Perhaps you could sort of enlighten us on to how that could work.
Well, circular procurement is really an enabler of circular economy. So it's about making those right choices early on in the product creation process so that the materials and components are suitable at end of life for either repair or refurbishment and reuse, and that helps to close the materials loop. It's also about, yes, waste minimisation, and if you look at in terms of the China National Sword Policy, that policy has been around for quite some time. The issue that we had at the beginning of 2018 was that the China actually strengthened that policy, and they had certain, they would only accept certain contamination limits. And up until that point, they were overlooking that and they were taking all the waste that was above those contamination limits. But they enforced those stringent limits back at the beginning of 2018 because, of course, they themselves are having a waste problem now, because everybody is shipping their waste to them.
What's fascinating is that we are faced with a challenge because someone is no longer willing to accept our waste, as opposed to trying to fix a problem, not because someone doesn't want to get our waste, but because we want to do the right thing.
Yes.
And that in itself is a bit wrong. We shouldn't be relying on countries around the world to accept the waste of other continents. That's just not fair, unless those countries can recycle those material efficiently and bring it back. So that I find this a little bit it just doesn't feel right with me.
Yeah, and ultimately it is the logical extension is, well, if we can't store it on this planet, that thing that we see every night, is that going to be our waste ground, and that can't be the, it's like sweeping it under the carpet. It can't be the right solution.
So it stems from what you pointed out earlier, the convenience of things. Yeah. If we just buy, upgrade and dispose, if we keep thinking that way, and you imagine if it's your household and you only have one bin, you'll end up with a full bin every night and there's nowhere to put it. So then that's why we're here trying to advocate and trying to give an awareness to everyone that we have to be mindful of our consumption and the way we think about ownership of things.
Mm. Yeah, and there's one thing that we forgot to touch on upon is the traditional way of mining, creating, manufacturing, selling, disposing creates a lot of carbon emission.
Yes.
Which in a circular economy, you limit those carbon emissions because you are no longer mining and moving items from country A to country B and through ships and factories and all of that. So it is reusing the content and at the same time saving, or helping the planet.
Yeah. And even just by not physically shipping, you're cutting the emission of the waste, of the transportation of waste from, say, from Australia to China. Just think, even that in itself, that activity and how many containers might just happen to fall into the ocean at the same time. So there's not only the emissions from the shipping, but there's also the potential for additional damage to be caused to the environment by.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, I used to grow. I grew up on the south coast of England, and
I'm sorry to hear that.
No, I know it was a bit too close to France for my liking, but it's no, that's not true. From quite an early age, it was a very common sight to see plastic and rubbish and things that had come in from Holland and from Denmark and just got caught in the shipping lanes and just landed up on our beach. And it was, initially it was quite, that was sort of, oh, this is quite interesting. What is that? And then after a while you start thinking, why is our beach just getting flooded with all this waste, detritus that actually, surely there has to be a better way of managing these things. And it's interesting you say about procurement being an enabler for a circular economy.
Yes.
I mean, if you've got that sort of support for it as a principle, how does it manifest?
Happen?
Yeah, how does it work?
Well, okay, let's start with one of the issues in one of the key enablers of circular economy, which is utility. If you have something, you need to have a maximum utilization of that something. And we in procurement, we buy things and sometimes it's only 50% utilized and then that sits there. So as we mentioned before, circular economy is creating value. If we are to rethink the way we buy, then we can specify what kind of materials we're buying so that it can extend its value. We can share its value, and then you can have savings. You can have less carbon emissions, carbon footprint. Government offices, they have now started sharing spaces, which is part of the sharing economy like Uber and Airbnb, which is something that is part of circular economy. The other thing that we can influence through procurement is specifying the materials that we buy. Is it something that we can repair? So let's say, for example, the chairs that you're sitting on at the moment. If something broke, you know what happens? They'll label it as broken, and then where does it go? Basement. After that, what happens? There is nothing that says that, okay, we can repair this component, and then we can put that chair to utility again. What ends up with the entire chair, it may get sent to the tip and it becomes landfill. We don't know. perhaps there are companies that are already doing some parts harvesting and parts recycling or remanufacturing, but I am not aware that we have something like in Japan, the extended supplier responsibility, where whatever they produce comes back to them.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, because they know for sure how to harvest the parts and how to remanufacture those parts and remove those harmful materials and components that could be toxic to our environment and to people. So that is one of the ways that I can say about procurement being an influencer, and I'm pretty sure Tanya has a few more examples.
But it's also about, and particularly in government procurement, it's about getting the best value for money. Mm. Where, you know, governments are spending public funds, and it's important that you get best value for money when spending those funds.
Yeah.
So in terms of, you know, not getting the longevity out of a product, well, that's wastage.
Yes. Yeah.
It's wastage, and you're spending more than you need to. But it's circular procurement. It's also about encouraging and rewarding innovation as well. So you want, if you're looking at, you know, in terms of the circular economy, you're looking at, you know, considerations of products from the design phase right through to the disposal. So when you're actually going through the procurement process, you're not just considering how that product is made, where you buy it from and how you use it. You're thinking about what happens to that product at its end of life.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are costs associated with that too. And it's not just about your financial costs. It's about your social costs and your environmental costs. So circular procurement is about considering that whole life cycle when making a purchase, which is about getting best value for money.
Exactly, yeah. And that is the key thing, isn't it? What the perception of value is and what the reality of value is. And the reality of value is, as you say, you know, you're spending the public's money, and they're trusting you to do it in the most appropriate fashion. And as you say, if the value is only 50% utilization, then you might do a great deal. The material might be fantastic, but it's not actually being utilized, and that in itself is because there's always a focus on how the public purse is managed and what it's about leading by example, which in itself has got to transition. I would hope it would transition into the private sector as well.
Yeah.
There might not be the same drivers, and certainly I started way back. I actually started in local government, so I understand the drivers and the dynamics from that side. And the scrutiny that you're placed under in terms of delivering. But then I've also worked in the private sector where those requirements aren't always of the same standard.
Yeah.
I think it's the nicest way for me to describe it.
Look at the example of car fleets, for example.
Let's.
What are the needs of the organization? To own a car or to be mobile?
Well,
so if it's so we really have to rethink the need of why we are buying things, you know, because we are doing a project for a car sharing company at the moment. We just hop in the car, use it, return it, and that's end of it. Versus, you know, an organization having a car fleet of 1,000 or 2,000 cars that is utilized, you know what I'm talking about.
I do know what you're talking about.
So if the real need is to help people move from A to B, do you really need to buy the car? So we really have to rethink the needs, the initial needs of the organization. And as part of this, as part of procurement, it's really help create those specifications to ensure that recyclable components are part, not obviously, maybe not so much in, maybe probably in the car as well, but recyclable component as part of a specification or requirements from the suppliers that we want to embed into the product that we are purchasing.
Christophe must be very, very fond of recycling.
Yes. I never waste anything, and I'm like, why do you have all this stuff?
Can we add to your repertoire virtualization? Mm-hmm. So, like, for example, when you said we need to rethink what we buy, we no longer want to buy a car, we want to buy an experience of transportation.
Correct.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So you don't, do you have to buy it? Can you rent it? You know, something like that. I've read something, which is a very good example, about light as a service. Have you heard about that?
I've read about that.
Organization needs light. They need to be, their office needs to be lit up, but they don't have to buy the lighting equipment. So Philips actually agreed to develop a service solution that they don't have to own the fixtures. And that way Philips has the control over how do they take the materials back and recycle them and repurpose them.
Oh, wow.
But the client has the light. So it's the same thing in government. You know, we have fleet, we have travel, we have electricity, we have food. So all of these things we can exchange. We can maybe specify components that are upgradable. Some parts are upgradable with new technology. Is it something that can be shared, which I mentioned before? Can it be virtualized so you don't have to physically transport the product from one place to another? So other than recycling, there are many, many ways to actually have...
And the role of procurement is key. For example, this beautiful building, the New South Wales Department of Education, is a gorgeous building. How long is it going to live? And at the end of its life, how much needs to be destroyed and how much can be reused? Has the building be designed in such a way that when you dismantle the building, you can reuse?
Can I mention something? I'm glad you mentioned that, because let's not talk about this building.
Yeah. Or
but
any building.
Other buildings, before the agile workplace was introduced, we have fixed tables and chairs and cubicles, correct? And then agile workplace was introduced only quite recently, and they dismantled everything. So we have fully functioning footrests, fully functioning chairs, fully functioning tables, document holders, ring binders. Because the building has been redesigned, all of those were thrown away. So I've actually proposed to the procurement board before, which that idea was openly received, that we can repurpose this. How about if another agency needs this supply, we should just be able to transport it to them and they can reuse it so that they can hold procurement, they can postpone procurement, and therefore they can have savings. So that's one way of achieving savings, because procurement's one major aim is to achieve bankable savings. So that's just one way. But there are challenges because... And I think we need to talk about more challenges in here, Andy and Christophe, because one of the challenges is our contract. If we have a look at our contracts, it doesn't say that these items can actually be shared or transferable. It solely belongs to you because I have sold it to you.
Yeah.
I am not aware of some, maybe there are in other industries, but certainly where I know and I have seen, that's one of the challenges, because we can't just give it to another organization.
I can't think of too many examples where that would be the norm, that you could pass that on and share. And it's interesting, even just by using that, the Uber and Airbnb, you know, as a more obvious public-facing model people accept, but how much more almost social the changes are going to be that we're going to be undertaking in terms of how we operate. So if you're sharing light, if you're sharing heat, if you're sharing transport, and whereas in one of the discussions around the digital age that we're living in, that people are actually becoming more internally focused and it's just about what's going on their screen. The reality of it is, a lot of what's being able to be facilitated. So if you want to order your car, Uber, or whatever, you do it by your phone. But the reality is, if you're then car sharing, it's become more of a social activity. And the ultimate only way that we're going to enable, fully enable a circular economy, fully within that, having circular procurement, is by being more social and actually recognizing the internal impact.
But aren't we going against what we've been sold? Like, you need to have your own car.
And
you need to have the most expensive cars. And so we are going back to the, 15, 20, 30, 40 years ago, where be free, have your own car. And now we are saying, please don't have your own car, but use public transportation.
It comes down to a culture change as well. And it comes down to showing what the true value of that is. Because I know, you know, personally, we do have a car, and there are times that we need a second car, but we don't. We haven't purchased a second car because we use GoGet service. And it's actually cheaper when you look at all of do the economics, it actually is cheaper just to sign up to a GoGet and just rent that whenever you need it.
Yeah.
So I think it is about a culture change, and it's about showing people that, you know, really it's more economically and financially better for you if you don't purchase that and that you use it through some kind of share service or lease.
And I think the intriguing thing, the point to your point, Christoph, about actually the this is the model we've been, so you've got to have your own home, you've got to have your own car, you've got to have this, in continental Europe it's not a prerequisite to own your own home. Far less than it is in.
Most people do their own home at the end when they retire. They buy the home back then. But when I first came to Australia, it was just like you need to have your home like straight away. And everyone
And I think that's maybe part of the sort of Anglo-Saxon culture, because that's certainly the way it has been in the UK. And but the opportunity now is, you know, people saying, well, if you, you know, how are we going to be able to build the, you know, grow the economy if everybody's not buying houses? But I say, you know, we can create the houses, but you can lease them, you can, you know, share them, and it's the same in all the, you know. So one of the things that's been restraining it is the economic enabler for businesses, you know, bigger businesses. But we've always, you know, we are. I won't pick a real car company. We are, you know, Christoph at Autos.
Thanks a lot for not picking a real one. Yeah. How do you know?
Well, yes, couldn't afford.
Do you produce electric cars?
Exactly.
Well, that's a topic that, you know, electric cars, that's another big one as well. So on one side, if we touch quickly on that, on one side, it's electric. You don't use fossil fuel. But what are the costs to actually manufacturing a battery? And what do you do with that battery at the end of its life? Remember what we talked about many years ago. So
maybe you have to speak to our friend Gail Broadbent, who is an expert on electric cars.
I truly believe electric cars is cheap to run. The problem is the challenge, not so much the problem, but the challenge is the way they are to manufacture that battery is very intensive in terms of manufacturing.
I think just coming back to that bit about how do we, you know, particularly when you're having back to circular procurement, you're sort of saying, well, the people that you're buying from, they say, yeah, but we want to, you know, for example, this table in this nice meeting room we're in, you say, yeah, but this table has got a life expectancy of X, and then when it gets to the end of X, we'll sell you another table. And you're saying, well, actually, we don't want to keep on buying tables. We want to buy, we want to have a table. Now, whether we buy it or we lease it or we make it or we do something, what is it?
And so that comes down into the holistic approach of total cost of ownership and manufacturing. And I like your when you mentioned leasing it, if you're leasing it to the manufacturers, well, I guess it's not enough. We have to speak to them and say, well, we're leasing it, but do we understand that you are actually into circular economy where you repurpose or remanufacture these materials? Because all we need is a table. You give us another table, and then whatever happens to the old table gets emerges into a different form.
There's quite a famous soft drinks brand that are promoting the fact that their bottles are now being made from recycled bottles and recycled all sorts, and it's fascinating the acceleration and the acceptance. I think the acceptance by the general public is, of course, you're going to do that. You know, if you talk to my children are 18 and 20 and just come out of school, incredibly aware that their expectation is, you've made a pretty bad job of this planet so far. You know, now it's your responsibility and ours to make a change on it. And initiatives like a circular procurement model, and in terms of how it is actually manifesting itself in New South Wales at the moment, can you share some of the thinking around that?
Well, when you talk about the recycled content in the drink bottles, so I'd say that that's coming from a push from government policy. So we've got the national waste policy, and there are certain targets that have come out of that policy that the Australian Packaging Covenant organisation, they've got certain targets that they need to meet, and to be able to do that, then yes, they have certain targets around percentage recycled content coming out of producers.
Yeah.
So they are following through with that. So
excuse my ignorance on this. Is there a penalty if they don't achieve these targets?
Oh, that I don't know.
Yeah. Because it's an intriguing thing. I mean,
we don't impose penalties.
Yeah.
We give incentives. let's not talk about penalties.
Okay, no, but that's great. It's good to understand that.
Yes,
yeah.
I think there are no penalties, but the government keeps on looking for ways to encourage good behaviour and this behaviour of recycling and, renewable sources. So, yeah.
Are we in a position to, be
incentivizing.
Yeah, I went way beyond my league here.
This is a big one.
Helping businesses through financial incentive, here we go, I said it another way, to look for supplies, products that are a certain level of recycled material.
I can't talk about financial incentives, but in procurement, there are incentives in terms of weightings. So there are now mandatory weightings for sustainability, which is a non-price weighting. So when we buy, we ask for suppliers to demonstrate that they're actually using recyclable materials, or are they producing recycled products. So that's one of the incentives.
But that's not a policy at the moment. That's just a suggestion that you should be heading this way. There's not a requirement as part of the tender.
Somehow, it is part of the small and medium enterprise and regional policy.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. With local government, there's nothing in the Local Government Act per se. It's more around individual councils and what they have within their policy. Mm. I know it at local government procurement. So we manage a number of contracts where councils can purchase through those contracts rather than going through the tender process if they are spending above the threshold value that requires them to do so. In terms of our contracts, what we're doing is that when we get to that RFT stage, we're putting sustainability criteria within that RFT.
Okay.
There is some weighting to it. It's not great, it's not a large weighting or anything, but there is some weighting to it.
A, that it's in there, B, that there's an element of weighting in there.
And we do ask the question around recycled content, but the main way that we address the sustainability in there is around asking tenderers to outline what the sustainability opportunities are that they can offer to councils. So, and we give them guidance notes about what to include in there, and some of that is around reduced packaging. It's around that durability and longevity of products. It's about what they're providing can lead to waste reduction. It's what maintenance and repair opportunities are there, and we tailor that to that category. So we look at the risks associated with that category and we tailor those questions to that. Now, all the responses that come in from tenderers are then included within the buyer's guide under those contracts. So then it's up to the purchasers to go in, which is generally councils, to go in and they can have a look at the responses to those questions, and that can help them make their decision.
Okay.
But ultimately it comes down to what they have within their own council policy.
Okay.
Well, that's already a good start.
Yeah,
you know, that's really a good start to, you know, to do the right, you know, the
Absolutely.
Right behavior. So, if you were to give some advice to either other government agencies or private organizations on how to start on this circular, I was going to say sustainable, but it is sustainable. It's also circular economy via procurement. What would you start with? Rethink the needs, perhaps right at the beginning, or what?
Well, I guess you need to look firstly within your governance structure and what your policy is like. What we have a look at what you want to achieve through circular economy principles,
mm-hmm.
and you need to include that, you know, because you need a strong governance structure behind your processes to be able to achieve those goals. Well, you need to know what your goals are, what your drivers are. And I guess that's where, you know, Myla and I were both on the Australian Committee for the development of the Sustainable Procurement Standard, ISO 20400. And I know that I promote to councils to implement the framework underneath that guideline. And that all follows about looking at what your drivers are and the risks and the opportunities, and that where you can really, really push those circular economy principles is about looking at what the opportunities are. And
we'll put those links as part of the description of the podcast. Yeah.
So. Yeah, and it's about engaging with your supply chain. So there is a huge social component to circular economy and circular procurement. So it's about developing those relationships with suppliers to both achieve the goals that you want.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of government, it's about the relationship that you have with your communities, because generally the communities have quite a strong sustainability focus. If you look at particularly most Sydney councils and a lot of regional councils as well, the communities are really strong on sustainability, and councils have very strong sustainability objectives.
Which is fantastic. I mean, in terms of the challenges that, you know, that we face in New South Wales and Australia, what, you know, is, is everything okay, or is there a lot more to do? So
I have attended the kickoff meeting of the, what's the network called, the Circular Economy Network. I think it's now called New South Wales Circular. And a few of the challenges, sorry, I'm catching my breath.
It's okay. It's a very emotional topic.
This is, one of the challenges that were identified is the acceptance in the industry, because there are companies who embrace this fully, and they have actually developed products based on materials that are recycled or harvested. However, we have regulations, we have specifications, we have standards, and I think we haven't caught up yet in updating some standards when it comes to these new materials. Because even though they are as good as the traditional ones that we use, when we buy and we specify, it's not there. So we can't choose them.
Yeah.
So that becomes a problem, because we have an equally strong alternative, but we are not able to choose them at the moment. So that's one challenge.
Yeah.
Another challenge is with us, the procurement professionals ourselves. We need to understand that we are already very savvy on this, because we do that for ourselves.
Yeah.
When we buy a car, when we buy a handbag, when we buy our clothes, we know what's best value. We know what lasts long. But we need to transfer it into our professional life.
Yeah.
So when we're trying to specify, we need to identify, are these products and materials long enough to withstand how many years? Can I sustain and prolong the value of my asset and investment? Or if I have to break it apart, can this be valuable for other things? It's just one simple step like that, so that we can, and then we can tie in what Tanya said about engaging with the suppliers and the industry, because they can always do something for us. They're always happy to have a conversation and say, okay, we're going to partner with you. And for this, especially government is one of the largest buyers. We have leverage because we can buy, you know, in large volumes.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the conversations that we've had earlier on the podcast about actually people underestimate the kudos and credibility of either, whether it be government or, state, federal or local, government. The value of actually saying, for the suppliers themselves to say, oh yeah, and we supply to New South Wales government. That's not always highlighted as a positive, and particularly if you're saying our expectations around how we're going to procure in the future there's an expectation around circular procurement that they can then say, okay, now we need to embrace this to win this business. We'll apply that to our own, all of our clients. And that, and it's then the clients start going, oh, what's this circular procurement thing?
You know what, that's pretty missing cool. Because the conversation, when in government, a few of us have already embraced that early engagement, but mostly it's still arm's length.
Yeah, yeah.
And that conversation is missing. Because if you imagine you are a supplier, you have R&D. You have 5 years ahead of you thinking about what's going to happen to my product. But we don't know that.
Yeah.
What we know is what we need in the future. But if that conversation happens, then that's big magic can happen.
We're happy to facilitate that conversation.
It's about the extended supply chain and dealing with your supplier, but your supplier, suppliers. And
Designing, then supplier, supplier, supplier.
And then working jointly as an extended enterprise for the end consumer benefit in the case of government, taxpayers, which is everyone, and hopefully everyone. Yeah. So it's really opening that conversation and not just having a contract with the supplier because you've got the best price.
Yeah, and don't forget, the first principle of circular economy is designing waste and pollution.
Yeah.
So at the very, very first step, that conversation happening, we should be able to already factor out that waste.
Yes. Which is great.
And it requires it requires investment as well, and buyers need to be prepared to pay for that investment.
Yeah.
And think of it in terms of the value for money concept and what they are going to save forward.
Yeah, it's such.
It's not about what you.
And we go back to the initial point. Yeah.
Back to Christoph. Well, I want it cheaper. I want it now. And I don't care what happens to it. To paraphrase, and it is what is so this additional cost, and then you say, well, the margin that you save by not undertaking a more precise and relevant and environmentally and socially savvy position, what's the cost of not doing that ultimately?
Exactly.
And that's the flip point, isn't it?
And so, they don't often the true pricing is not established. You're not looking at the social and environmental costs in price.
Maybe we're looking at it from the wrong lens. We're looking at it from the micro lens, which is within an organization. But if we look at it from a regional or country lens, then suddenly how much carbon emission do you remove? How much waste is no longer a problem?
Yeah, well, circular economy and circular procurement is a combination of many things and many factors and many industries. It's just, it cannot happen in isolation. And exactly what you said, it has to be from a global or universal perspective.
And and the obvious knock-on in terms of the cost benefit to a country is if you're not polluting the country which you live in, if carbon emissions reduce, or your planet, but ultimately the planet, of course. Yeah, I mean, pollution doesn't go down regional lines or country. Doesn't just stop at this barrier. Because they've got a great policy, so therefore we're not. This pollution will just go round. But it is the true saving is it's also reflected in terms of the physical health of the nation. Yes. So the physical health of the nation. And so if you've got less people taking time off work because they're unwell, if you've got less people in hospital, less people dying, you know, and you've got a healthier, more vibrant culture within a country and with a planet,
then everybody wins. Yeah.
It's a win-win. So I think we just
except for the organization chasing a profit, perhaps because the cost of that. So it's a whole mind. So
you and your profit.
No, I know, but this is unfortunately how companies think.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, no, I didn't mean to belittle that position, but it's a very valid point. And having worked for an organisation who ostensibly, on the one hand, was very pro trying to make a positive impact on the environment, but in reality, some of the key commercial decisions they had to make to sustain their share price meant that if it comes down to a particular position, share price beats the environment, and that's part of it's almost part of the way the economy is modeled needs to be to potentially be rethought.
Yeah, well, if I could give an example regarding that, it's related. This company called Sendul, you can look them up. They are a logistics company, but their promise is a zero emission and zero carbon footprint, even though they are a logistics company. How do you think they are doing it? I don't have I can't see their books, but I'm pretty sure that the way they are expanding, they are very profitable. Yeah. It's because they piggyback on the capacity of other logistics company. Yeah. So you know how when you do a removal list, they go to one point, they're full, they come back, it's empty?
Yeah.
That kind of concept. Yeah. You utilize that capacity to reduce the number of cars going out on the streets. Yeah. So there are many logistics companies, cold chain and other things that I don't know if they're talking to each other, but there is peaks and troughs in low and high capacities that they can actually use.
But ultimately, we want to remove any carbon emission, any movement, that contributes negatively to the planet, whether or not this is possible. You can always compensate or optimize an existing movement and making sure that that asset is utilized to the best possible way. But even doing that, you're still contributing negatively to carbon emission.
But it's less, it's half.
It's less, of course it's less. Yeah.
And if everybody is doing that, there could be a significant reduction. We probably can't do a total removal of those emissions because we can't leave.
Yeah.
But are going to be enhancing the development of our national supply. Yeah.
Which is fantastic. I mean, I think, it's very obvious from the conversation that we've been having, just how much value, coming back to the value point, that circular procurement enables the circular economy to happen. In terms of the, I suppose, conscious of time and but in terms of how the next steps for New South Wales and for local government, are there any particular initiatives that you can, we're not expecting state secrets, but if there's anything you can share in terms of the initiatives, that might be a really nice way to leave on a positive note.
Well, the Office of Environment and Heritage have already published the government circular economy policy, which is a very, very good positive step. And many agencies are now following suit and buying recycled paper and focus on reducing waste. And that's really good. But we could do better because we obviously, if we look at recycling from design to waste, recycling is somewhat here on the other end. Maybe the next step is we need to educate our procurement professionals to implement the design stage and what we have right now. Think about increasing the utilization. So I guess that's why Tanya and I are here in our capacities as, passionate in procurement to give awareness.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if anyone could do the same thing, that would probably be a very good next step
Fantastic.
Is there any resources that people can jump in, any associations, if they want to learn more, whether, you know, within your local government procurement or national association that you could list? And then we'll put the link into the description.
Yeah, well, at local government procurement, we have our sustainable procurement service, which is what I manage. And, we have a lot of resources and guidance and advice for councils and linking councils together, you know, that are doing great things and showing case studies and building that awareness, many online resources that can help. That's in terms of what we do and what we have available.
Yeah, and I guess for whole of government, there's a New South Wales Circular website. It's where the network, actually they publish case studies as well as opportunities for circular economy in the Office of Environment and Heritage, and also the ISO 2400.org is a good resource.
And then there's the Ellen MacArthur Foundation.
The Ellen MacArthur Foundation, yes.
The list goes on. It's fantastic.
Yes, it's quite a lot.
How reassuring is that? That's just wonderful that, you know, the government, you know, and governments within the government are taking such a positive step, and that there's resource, there's passion for it, which is has come across in our chat today. We're only going to chat for 10 minutes and look how far we've gone. But
but it's also about collaboration too. Yeah. You know, it's about everybody working together. So it's not just about your procurement team looking at this. It's about everybody across an organisation looking at it. And it's also about collaborating with, you know, maybe you're purchasing but you're not the end user, collaborating with the end user and the supplier and the manufacturers. It's all working together to come up with the solution rather than working in isolation. You know, everyone talks about silos and wanting to break silos, but there's silos everywhere.
Yeah, it's true.
And you know, and that's one thing that I really push with people that I deal with. It's like, but you can't just be focusing on it from your perspective. You need to go and talk to everybody else within your organisation. You need to all fit together or work out, you know, look at everybody's perspectives, what everybody's needs are, and come up with a solution together.
I think that's fantastic. I think it, you know, and it isn't about leaving it. It's like my teenage sons, you know, go into their bedroom, and if you don't pick up the stuff that's on the floor, then nobody's going to do it. Actually, you know, we as a planet are now old enough to tidy up our own bedrooms, I think. And I think it's the next step. And in terms of real positive advocates for that, I think what we've been chatting about proves the fantastic strides that are being taken. So from my point of view, thank you both very much for your time on the podcast. Christoph, you'd like
to... thank you very much, Tania and Myla. Any listeners having any questions, feel free to email info@procurementpodcast.com and we'll put the list of resources as part of the description of this podcast. Myla, Tania, thank you once again, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Procurement Podcast with Andy and Christoph. For more information, please visit our website, procurementpodcast.com, and feel free to email us your questions at info@procurementpodcast.com.